The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to episode 32 of Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
If this is your first time listening to Unsound Methods, this is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, approach and technique.
In this episode, we speak to the Irish-Canadian author Anakena Schofield. We had a great wide-ranging chat about her process and we spoke to Anakena. She was in Vancouver and we were both in London during COVID lockdown in early July.
Anakena is the author of Malarkey, Martin John and Biner, which was published in the UK earlier this year. So here is Anakena Schofield. Do you write every day or do you go through phases of blasts of creativity and quiet phases?
I despair every day. That is probably 88% of my creative process.
That sounds relatable.
Despair. I always wonder about these questions about, you know, like I'm always curious about this. Like, what is it we're trying to understand? Because if you look at biographies of writers, the one that comes to mind is I was going to call him D.H. Lawrence, but I wanted to say David Foster Wallace. Sorry, I was going to say D.H. Lawrence, but I'm actually trying to refer to D.F.W. David Foster Wallace. I don't know if you noticed in his there was a book that was written about him and how he was writing. I think he was writing sort of emails, or maybe they were cards and letters to Don DeLillo, asking, you know, freaking out, sort of asking, are you writing every day? And so it's quite interesting, the sort of writerly fixation on this. Because I think maybe on some level, writers are kind of fascinated by it because they're trying to figure out how the fuck do you do this thing, even though they've done it 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times before. And I think that's actually kind of the beautiful, obscene thing about the process of trying to write a novel, especially, is how relentlessly elusive the process is. And so you never, ever feel like you're summiting anything. And then, mm-hmm. you know, somehow it either does end or it doesn't end. And if it doesn't end, usually you have to put it away under your bed. And if it does end, it might be because you owe somebody money. Right? Like there's somebody who's given you money anticipating you're going to give them a book. So either if you've no means to find the money to give them the money back, at some point you're going to have to give them a book. I think it's a deeply mysterious process that I think none of us actually have any understanding of. This seems to be different if you are somebody, for example, who perhaps writes in a genre and you are required to produce a book a year, right? Like some writers produce one book a year. Or, mm-hmm. I mean, Josh Simenon, however you say that name, produced one every, I think, 7 days. In which case there may be a more of a sort of streamlined process, but I think the question was, do I write every day? And the answer is yes, I do write every day in some way, shape or form. And I don't, and if I don't write, I get very distressed. That doesn't necessarily mean it makes me write, but,
just add the despair for the next day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably not a good person to ask about this process. I'm going to depress every single person out there. In fact, yeah, you know the way they say, oh, we should take that person and we should bottle them and, you know, spray them around the room to make everybody cheerful. Yeah, I'm not that person. They'll want to do that. They'll want to bottle me for the utopic pessimism hour, not for, productivity and how to get things done.
But I think to be able to be open about that, that this sort of despair that, that might come with it is a good and is a positive thing. But it's a useful thing for people to be aware of, because otherwise it's that the idea that you're doing something wrong if it's not just the thing you jump out of bed full of joy to do, and, you know, that it's completely life-affirming all the time rather than feeling like this horrendous kind of obligation, but you've got to do it. That's an interesting thing to explore, I think.
Yeah, I don't actually believe you could write, certainly not literature that is making an inquiry of literature, if, you were approaching it like you do wearing a Fitbit or something. I mean, I've heard people say this, and I just frankly can't relate to it at all. It's not a process where you put your feet down in front of each other and, you know, paddle along the footpath for 10,000 steps. This is a mysterious process that, I mean, I've published 3 novels, and I've published another book that was an art book. And before that, I wrote 3 books before I published my first novel. It took 3 books to get that novel. It took 10 years. So, I just think there's so much literature in the world. You know, if you're going to put a book in the world, there probably needs to be a reasonably good reason for doing so. And my view is that people publish far too much and far too soon, because you're going to get a horrible shock. You know, but I have just a very different view on this. I mean, often when I'm asked to give talks at universities or colleges, and who knows, maybe I won't be asked to give them anymore after now having given some, but, I say it's a life's work, it's not a career, which kind of sounds a little oxymoronic, and I'm certainly not trying to be disingenuous to the notion of career. I just really do think you know, this is not like being in the civil service, right? You're not like trying to pass through grades. I mean, it's not for me. You know, that's not my experience. But maybe if I was writing a different type of novel or different book, I would feel differently about it. I don't.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a case that sort of genre or not plot necessarily, but certain types of novels lend themselves more to a sort of pre-planning phase, a planning phase, plotting out.
There's expectation.
Type of writing.
Well, there's the fact is that there's expectation from the readers for certain types of books. But I'm not trying to be disingenuous to genre writing at all, because actually it's very, very difficult to write genre very, very well. Like, often people think, oh, well, I'll just, you know, well, I'm a poet, so I'll just mosey on over here and write some, you know, hot erotica or something, and they discover actually writing hot erotica is, you know, just as complicated in its own way as trying to write, you know, readable poetry. And so then you get, you know, and that's, I don't know, I have kind of a different view on this. I really have this kind of, perhaps it's a bit old-fashioned, but, you know, I think if you're a short story writer, write the best fucking short stories you can. Like, be brilliant at writing the short story. You know, if you're a poet, like, I mean, poetry is the hardest thing to write. But I think there's a terrible, misnomer that you're not a writer until you've written a novel. And it's just bonkers and batshit, and it's simply not true. And we end up with an awful lot of mediocre novels. And we also end up with, you know, novelists writing mediocre poetry. You know, but this is the nature of, like, capitalism and market forces shaping our writing and our reading. And at the end of the day, you do have to feed your chickens. So I just respect, or I do respect anybody who does whatever they do. It's really, really difficult to write anything, except maybe the back of a cereal packet. I think that's something I could get very good at and be confident about, you know, Shreddies or Ready Breath or something.
I'm sure the copywriters who do that have their own personal torment.
I'm sure they're sitting there right now listening to this, because let's face it, copywriters on the back of cereal packets, regular listeners to podcasts about experimental literature, are sitting there right now going, who's that Harrigan? And they're probably sitting now sharpening the pencils to write me hate mail. Like, how dare you underestimate?
You think you've got despair every day.
Think, yeah, let me tell you. Let's have an MMA-style existential face-off between, you know, the Shreddies copywriters and that Harrigan in sunny Vancouver.
I just wanted to go back to something that you mentioned earlier, which is something that I don't think we've really spoken to people about, but I found it very interesting because I think this is quite a common experience. You said that you wrote 3 novels before your first was published. So with those novels, I'm interested in whether you used anything from them for the novels that did get published, or whether you kind of knew that you were working out what you were doing through them.
Well, it basically, it's tricky because, you know, I finished Malarkey in 2011. I published it in 2012. It took the guts of about 10 plus years to write that book. I'm 49 years old, so my memory's not that great. I think I've blocked out a lot of that time. I just remember, okay, so there was a whole novel that I wrote that was nothing to do with the novel Malarkey, nothing to do with that. It was a novel set in, I think, the 60s in New York, and it was about a man and his sort of daughter. I've always had this weird sort of son, sort of daughter thing going on. In Bina, I have a sort of son. And it was really, it seemed to be about the Catholic worker movement. I can't even really remember, but there's boxes of it here. But I was never satisfied with that novel. I'm sure, to be honest, I could have published it. But I decided not to publish it. And because my publisher, my editor was constantly saying to me, where's that novel? Where's that novel? And I was like, you're not seeing that novel. Nobody's seeing that novel. That novel is dead. It's gone. So that was definitely an entire novel. Then, so essentially when I say that I wrote 3 books, like I had to write 2 different versions, really 2 other books that really ended up being Malarkey, except that one of them, so Malarkey was a parallel narrative with 2 mothers and 2 sons. And then towards the end, I took a whole mother and a whole son and threw them out. And then there were elements of the stuff I threw out that subsequently went on to become, I think there's maybe 5 lines that became Martin John and his mother. I think there's basically 5 lines that survived, and that became Martin John. I don't know is the answer. I don't know.
You mentioned earlier on this sort of approach of writing being about your life as opposed to like a job in the civil service. How much do you think you sort of had to write those first novels to get to the stage where you could write Malarkey and Martin John? Well, how much is it that you were just in the right place later in your life when you did write Malarkey that it worked that time and it hadn't worked?
No. Previously. Just to clarify, it isn't about my life. I see, because you said about your life. I know you probably don't mean that, but I want to be very clear. I don't write autofiction. And there's a very good reason for being very clear about that, because I could probably have to serve about 2 prison sentences if I was writing autofiction. It's more conceptually. I think of it as a body of work. I think of it as a life's work. And that way it takes away pressures to have published X amount of books in X amount of time and to have hit X amount of markers. Like, that just doesn't exist for me. Because it can't, because I'll go absolutely demented and write possibly very terrible books. I mean, some people may think the books I've written are very terrible, but trust me, if I wasn't conceiving of it in this way, the books that I have written would be a great deal more terrible, because, you know, I'd have rushed them into existence and I wouldn't have had I wouldn't have sustained the curiosity that they required to make, to become what they became. I would have been satisfied much sooner, because I would just be intent on, okay, well, I want to have published this number of books by this age. And I can't even begin to describe how you live like that, because it's just not how I don't even know how people do that. But, you know, some people are very goal oriented, and I just don't think it works with art making.
Do you think you had to set down the words for those novels that you never published? Did you have to set those words down on the page and then discard them to get to Malarkey? Or could you have never written anything and just started Malarkey when you started it?
No.
And it would be different, obviously. But
no, I was trying to find a form, because the problem was I thought novels had to be written. I'm obviously influenced by the Irish lyrical tradition, because, you know, I'm mixed, because I was born in England. My father was English, my mother's from rural Ireland. So I'm in that way, but I'm very influenced by the Irish language, and because that's my mother tongue, right? Because that's when I say my mother tongue, I mean Hiberno English is my mother tongue, because that's the language my mother speaks. And my father died when I was very small, so the primary linguistic influence is listening to my mother. So, okay, what was my point? What was I trying to say? I think I felt I had to write novels the way Colm Tobin wrote novels, or Colm McCann, and they were always men, because, you know, those were the writers that one could be exposed to, per se. So I was trying to contract my prose to fit this kind of, you know, lyrical kind of heapy paragraphic type of work, and my prose just wouldn't contract in that way, and so I was perpetually frustrated, because for whatever reason, like, what I was doing with language, it wasn't fitting with any of that sort of more traditional stuff. So I had to fail very badly for a very, very long time, until I, you know, began to look at other forms. And I was kind of influenced by concrete poetry. And that's why I have got the kind of form-bending work that I have. It was very much built out of not being able to conform. Like, it's not like I've set out to, you know, to be experimental, far from it. And I don't actually genuinely believe my work is that experimental. I just think that the middle brow has just taken over, and anything that's, I mean, bloody hell, anything now is considered experimental, because, you know, literary fiction has just become so, like, desperately middle brow.
And was that a realization that you had? Can you sort of pinpoint having worked on the novels and feeling frustrated, and then one day sort of going, aha, this is how I need to approach things? Or was it more of a gradual shift in your direction of what you were doing?
Well, the big issue for me was always time and point of view. I really resented the way that literary fiction writers, and I say this a lot when I'm teaching, like, what you push against is as important as what you read towards. So I'm always encouraging students, if I'm working with students or I'm working with writers, to pay attention to what they're resistant and where they resist, because this is very important, right? Because that defines, like, that's how you're defining your space as a writer. So that's how you're kind of carving out a place for your within your language and what have you. So it was time frustrated me, because I felt like, well, this chronological linear, fucking the, you know, the momentum, the notion of resolution, everything about it is completely antithetical to the experience of being a human, and especially the experience of being a poor human. You know, I mean, economically, I'm quite interested in sort of working class lives in this way. I'm not interested necessarily in, you know, making novels that are socially anthropological, like, but in that case, I'd just kind of write a soap opera, or I'd write social anthropology studies. I'm interested in taking, like, the highest notions or quality elements of prose and literary terms and applying them to those lives. Because I really do believe that you can give status on the page that doesn't exist in life. So you can have rich inner lives for people. You know, we just assume that the poor don't have rich inner lives, but we don't actually know that for a fact. So that's the beauty of being a fiction writer. I can say, well, just a minute. You know, I'm going to make my you know, woman, elderly woman in rural Ireland, very philosophical, like Beowulf, right? Like having her own battles. So that was really important to me, that I was fighting the notion of time. And I remember actually one mentor that I worked with saying to me, Anna Kena, you know, things happen in a very rational, logical manner. And it was, of course, terrible advice, but it was beautiful because, of course, that was the battle. Mm. Like to me, that notion of logic and rational is completely fallacious. I mean, for example, my first novel was about grief and it was about sexuality. Well, you can't find two more, like, first of all, sexuality is immensely fluid. I mean, I know there's going to be a bunch of people that probably jam the switchboard to argue with me about this, but, you know, look at the Kinsey survey or whatever it's called. Like, there's a fluidity with sexuality. Like, it's not as bordered as we've tried to imagine. And likewise, grief. Grief doesn't happen in a linear fashion. You know what I mean? Grief accumulates. It's an accrual, and you will grieve people out of sequence. So I've always had this tension with the like notion of the 24-hour day and the month and the 12 months, and I've been trying to find different ways that formally are closer to the experience. So that's why I have, you know, people sometimes say, oh, it's confusing. Well, it's like, yeah, but life is confusing. Why would you expect a novel that in some way deals with human conundrums and philosophical inquiry? Why would you expect that not to be confusing? Ever been a human? Ever been confused?
I never get that as a kind of criticism of a work of art anyway, because yeah, there's so much in the world that's not sort of served up for you on a plate with everything completely explained and clear. And yet your brain can make sense of these things. It's a way of shining a different light, isn't it?
Absolutely nothing makes sense in life. I mean, if we just even went through the last 24 hours, I mean, we've never been in a more ripe time historically for like sheer, unmitigated lunacy and horror. I mean, like, I'm regularly confused. So I can't be the only confused person on the planet. And so, for example, so with Malarkey, it was like grief. Okay, how am I going to put the reader into the kidneys of this grief-stricken person? Just in the same way with Martin John. Like, Martin John had to be circular because all of the things are cyclical. He's a molester. He's a sex offender. He's a frateur. He's a flasher, and that behavior, you know, erupts and evolves and rotates. It's not something. It's cyclical. And then the notion, just like mental health, people who, because he's also quite mentally unwell, you know, again, it's a cyclical thing. So it had to be a very circular novel, right down to the syntax. I mean, that's actually quite a that's a syntactical work, that novel. I mean, I didn't necessarily realize that when I was writing it, but, you know, you have these refrains. Again, they're very circular. The novel is governed by the five refrains. You have him walking physical circles in Euston Station, and then you have him, you know, trapped in his own circuits.
So I think it's interesting that the regularity of the refrains and of the some of the mental processes in the novel, but then there's this sort of tension with, it's not sort of mantra like, or I mean it is in places, but there's this sort of erratic craziness as well that kind of pulls the other way and makes it not seem so cyclical, or from my reading of Martin John anyway, that there's a constant tension between things being regular and things being totally unregular and totally inexplicable or crazy.
Well, he falls, right? Like, his whole thing is his mother's voice telling him, you know, put your head down, get into bed at 9, Martin John. Don't put yourself in the way of trouble, and trouble won't find you. You know, I mean, there is a layover there's some stuff kind of fell over from Martin John into Bina, because in Bina, I look at the notion of a warning. I look at, okay, what is the language of a warning? You know, I look at time in Bina very differently. Like, it's much more concise, and she's restricted with what she can tell us. Like, the notion of what she can reveal is very important, because she's implicating herself. If she tells us certain things, she's implicating herself. So that's why I use like erasure, like it's blocked out, the so-and-so called. And originally I used the word redacted throughout, and I had this repetitious thing of redacted from the group phoned. So, I mean, if it was like a symphony, you know, I think Martin John and Bina would kind of be act two and act three. And Malarkey, I don't know. I mean, I think of them, originally I wanted to write a quartet of novels, because I'm quite influenced by music. I really love to think of, when I write a novel, I try to think a lot about scoring. And because, you know, I think that that's often a problem when we're reading novels. If we, like, when you go to the symphony or you go and you hear a piece of music, you know, you have light and dark and you have all this coloring and shade and you have the pause. And in some ways, like, novels, I think, can be composed similarly. And again, it's a more, for me as a reader anyway, I prefer to listen to a four-act novel than to, or to read a four, think of it as a four-act piece of music than the terminally sometimes dull renditions in which these tales are told. I can't, you know, and it's fine. Everybody else seems to be very happy with this, like, terminally, you know, sometimes I think, like, I don't know if you've ever done, like, sometimes if you do like a prize jury or something, or, you know, you're on a jury for some whatever, and you have to read like a big stack of work, you know, sometimes like 40% of it, you could stitch it together and it could be the same book. It's amazing sometimes how similar.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Unsound Methods. We hope you're enjoying the show. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter at Unsound Methods, or view our website at unsoundmethods.co.uk.
I think it's interesting, the idea of the sort of rhythm of literature. And I mean, I think it's absolutely true. There's got to be a rhythm and a sort of tempo to writing. But I think often it's kind of correlated with this sort of linear idea of time that you're getting away from. And I think good literature isn't constrained by that linear sense of time. But too often, the plot of a novel and how it progresses in time is seen as equated with the rhythm of the novel. And it does create a kind of dullness, because even if you've got a tightly plotted novel, it's not responding to rhythm in the same way that something more experimental and freeform can do, because the rhythm isn't tied to how the events happened in time. It's tied to the sort of internal structure of the novel itself, of the words, how they play with each other, which
is a whole different thing. If you even just take the most basic element of being a human, which is breathing, right? Like, people do not breathe at the same rate. Like, the nature of even taking a breath. I mean, sometimes people breathe really, really fast, and sometimes they breathe really, really slow, and sometimes the breathing is like patchy. So even if you took that as an entry point, it just doesn't make sense to me. You know, but like I say, I think a lot of it is predicated upon ease. The idea of that people maybe, it's an interesting time that we're living in. I mean, people are turning to the novel to find themselves, to read about themselves. And I just find that very strange. Why on earth would you want to read a book and find yourself? I can't imagine anything worse. It's bad enough to have to live with yourself. You're going to open a book just to discover, you know, somebody only who, you know, who renders you or feels like you or you identify with. I just have no interest in it. You know, but I recognize that, you know, there's about 3 people, you know, globally who agree with me. So that's fine.
But it's interesting.
That's fine. And they obviously clearly don't run necessarily publishing empires. although that said, I am published by, you know, the largest, you know, I'm published by Penguin Random House in Canada. I'm with Knopf Canada. And in the UK, the Little Brown Fleet published by now. So there are obviously some great, great people and thinkers in some of these companies. But yeah, I don't know. I just feel very differently. I relate to the world perhaps slightly differently. I mean, maybe I'm slightly brain damaged or something. I don't know. You know what I mean? I often wonder, did somebody drop me on my head when I was a child? Because I just have no, I don't share the same, as they say in Irish, I don't share the same grow for the mainstream ideas, right?
But that's kind of a good thing in your fiction, surely, because you were talking earlier about your characters and how they're not the characters who've been largely represented in, you know, throughout the past 400 years of fiction writing. For so much of it, it was, you know, the aristocracy and monarchs and you know.
Well, there's a lot of middle class as well, a very, very middle class, upper middle class. You know, it's certainly in British literature. It's flooded, right? but
I'm not. The albatross around our neck.
But that said, you know, I don't. You know, I'm wary of applying, you know, quota systems, you know, to literature. I mean, I really do think it comes down to the writing. I just am curious as to why, like, who do people see in life and why don't they see, say, like the bus driver or whoever as somebody who has potential to have a very rich, dramatic inner life. I find it really terminal that there are just so many people writing from the point of view of a writer. I can't imagine. There's nothing interesting. There is nothing interesting about my life as a writer. I'm not interesting as a writer. Maybe other people who write from the point of view of a writer are, you know, lead more interesting lives than I do. But no, I just can't. I can't quite relate to that.
So is that conscious then, though? Say Bynah, for example, who is a septuagenarian woman, who it's quite. People do become kind of invisible. I think the elderly in our society are just, you know, they're let to go off and do their thing.
Well, especially old women. And I've never understood this because old women are brilliant. They are absolutely fucking brilliant. I can't tell you. I just don't know how I would survive without old women. I mean, I am an old woman now. I'm almost 50 years old. And given the genes I have, I might not last very long. So you know, technically, I could be in my last hours. So technically, I'm an old woman.
Thank you for speaking to us during your essentially final hours.
Jeremy, which you just don't know, right? Although I used to have this argument with my doctor. I remember going in there saying I was middle-aged and I was like 33. And she kept saying, "You're not middle-aged." And I'd say, well, if you think about it, the average life is 70. So I'm right in the middle. I'm middle-aged, right? I have to say, it's interesting to me when I look at the 3 novels. Like, the first novel was about an older woman and it was, it was an exploration of grief and sexuality. And it was transgressive. I didn't actually realize that when I wrote it, but I realized that once people read it, it was apparently transgressive. Because, you know, essentially the mother is reenacting her gay son's love acts, amongst other things. And then Bynah is this 74-year-old who's just had enough. And, you know, she's not going around looking for a boyfriend. She's getting ready to leave the planet and she's just giving it to you. You know, she's not a mithering millennial, and I have nothing against mithering millennials. I have one right here in my apartment with me. And he's quite wonderful. He's my son, just to be clear. but, you know, like, to be in the mind of a 74-year-old woman in an unremitting, relentless way for 320 pages is a pretty rare thing. It's getting less rare, thank God. And I find it interesting that it seems to me that the response to those books, Martin John, on the other hand, is a sex offender. He's, you know, a disturbed and disturbing man. And yet, I think actually, publishing much preferred Martin John. Well, actually, that's not true. Nobody wants to publish him either. But I think, you know, like, we have an easier time processing Martin John than we do the, you know, very much the kind of blast furnace of Bynah. So there you go.
Says something, doesn't it? About
well, I got much poetry. More. I got more translation for Martin John than I did for either of the other books. So yeah, and even then, I didn't get that much translation because people are afraid of them. They think
what languages book, was it translated into?
It was translated into Turkish. It was translated into Quebecois, and it just came out. And then it was translated into French. I had two separate translations: one in French and one in Quebecois. Martin John, and it just came out in France actually in February, and it did very well. I mean, it got an amazing, amazing response there. And the timing was great because it came out in 2015 in Canada, which was pre-Me Too. Like, Me Too hadn't started. So then it just came out in France. And, you know, I think it's like Balance Ton Porc or something in French. So it certainly hit a nerve.
That's interesting. Yeah, it would suddenly have a different, like, context in society as a result of coming out either side of that. Yeah
It would have actually been it would have been interesting if, because it was before Me Too, so I think it actually would have been interesting if it had been, you know, if I'd somehow the times had converged. But maybe that wouldn't be interesting in terms of artistically, because that would have meant I'd have had to have written it in response to, whereas I didn't do that. I created a work independently of. So I don't know. I mean, I don't understand why it's not available in German. It's not available in Spanish. I speak Spanish. I can read German. But there you go. We need to have to talk to the German publishing industry. And I mean, I've really tried hard to get it into Spanish. So I don't know. But I love the fact that Turkey bought both of my novels and none of the other countries did. Turkey, you know, was considered so conservative and all the rest of it. We're throwing journalists in jail in Turkey, but they bought both of my novels. No other country did that. Actually, that's not true. France did. And so far, Bynah doesn't actually have any translation whatsoever. So, but it's a weird time, right? It's a very difficult time. You can't put any stock in anything at the moment because, you know, we're dealing with a pandemic and, you know, literary novels aren't, you know, we're more worried about manufacturing, understandably, vaccines and masks and rubber gloves.
Contributing as much as we might as writers.
Bynah came out literally as COVID hit in the UK. And so that means that any events I was planned to do have all been cancelled and, excuse me, but she actually got some very, very fine reviews over there. Very thoughtful, engaging reviews, which I'm just, you know, as a writer, you learn about what you've written from your readers. You actually, that's the interesting, this is why I talk about like daily despair, and because you have no real idea what you're up to. I mean, you kind of know what you're up to, but you'd never know if it becomes what it needs to become. And you just have to push on and push on until there's something indisputable about it and then make it more indisputable. But where you actually learn more about, say, like, I mean, psychoanalytically, you learn afterwards from readers. Like, it's amazing what you learn about your books that you have no clue about when you're writing them. And then somebody will go, oh, I noticed this. And you'll say, oh, wow, yeah, phew, blimey. So I love that part of the process. Like, I love the engagement with the book. I'm very, very blessed because my readers are obviously very, very smart and extremely good looking. Like, we know that. Like, all my readers, all of them, they are all splendidly smart and good looking.
I mean, I assume you have quite a broad range of readers from their backgrounds, because it's,
Oh yeah, it's amazing.
People are going to be interested in sort of investigating somehow. You seem to feel that transgressive was not exactly a label you might choose to apply to it. But
do you mean in terms of, yeah, I mean, I certainly do not set out to be transgressive. Far from it. I grew up like a strict Catholic and probably quite pious, actually. So if my books are transgressive in any way, shape or form, it's absolutely down to art making. It's not me personally setting out on a mission. You know, and that's one of the hard things about writing these books, right? You write these books and, you know, you take all these risks and you do all these courageous things and you like live for years with these difficult, long days and you despair and despair some more. And then finally, if you're lucky, it ends, or, you know, you basically have to recycle an awful lot of paper. And then there's a horrible moment that happens once you've like handed in a book and it's kind of a sad moment where you realize you just want people to like you and you've written another book and they're not going to like you. They're going to go, well, this is problematic and why did you do that? And then you just have to live with that, right?
Did you get much pushback with it? I mean, was there anyone who thought that it was kind of beyond the pale to have written from the point of view of someone who does what Martin John does on public transport?
Actually, you know, we really underestimate readers. Readers are so fucking smart. And they're hungry, actually, for challenge. And so I was really, really nervous. I thought Martin John would ruin me. Well, I thought Malarkey would be read by 4.5 people and I probably owed 3 of them money. I mean, because Malarkey has some, you know, pretty interesting sexual stuff in it. I realized that because I recorded the audiobook in February. I was in January. I was in Montreal for a couple of months and I ended up having to record the audiobook there. And I, you know, I had to read the book and the person I worked with was this lovely young man. He was about 30. And, you know, I had to read this into his ear every day and I was totally mortified. Like, oh my God. And even I was reading, I was like, oh God, how did I come up with this stuff? I always remember, because I remember years and years ago, I don't actually know how many years ago, because now I'm 49, everything is, you know, I just can't remember anything. Could have been last Tuesday. But Anne Enright said something in an interview with Eleanor Watt Patel, who's a radio host here in Canada. And she does a book program that I will never be on because she doesn't really interview Canadians. But Anne Enright was interviewed and Anne Enright made a comment about, I don't want to misquote her, but it was somehow connected to needing to do the dirty work that literary fiction requires. So I kept that in my mind a lot when I was writing Malarkey. And a lot at the end of it, there was a bunch of scenes. There's one scene in particular where the mother, episode 2, if you're reading along at home, the mother sees, or maybe it's episode 3, the mother sees her son giving it anally to a younger boy in her field. And so she's not quite sure what she's seeing. And I remember that scene, and it's told from the point of view of a mother who's a farmer who just doesn't really know what she's seeing. So it's actually quite funny. But I remember thinking, oh, it's too much, it's too much, it's too much. I better throw it out. You know, nobody's going to want to read this. Like, it's just too much. And then luckily my lovely friend Marina Roy, who's a visual artist, said, oh, God, no, it's so good. And da-da-da. And so because she urged me to keep it, I swear to God, I've been dining out on that scene for about 7 years. That book is taught in sexuality classes because of that scene, right? So the very thing that I thought was just too much, that was just going to ruin me as a writer, that people would be just appalled by. And I mean, that wasn't even the half of that book. Because then the mother goes on and she essentially tries to kind of reenact what she saw her son doing. Luckily, nobody seemed to notice the reviews, right? It was a D.H. Lawrence thing. I was playing around with this idea of D.H. Lawrence, you know, the Japanese wrestling and the colliery managers. and them conflating these two things together. And so I wanted to, you know, I was trying to do the same sort of thing like D.H. Lawrence did, which is take very less likely things and you know, conflate them, let them meet in a kind of nice explosive way.
In terms of your process, like with that scene, do you sort of tend to write the whole draft in one go, and then is once you'd written the draft that you were sort of going back and thinking, oh, maybe I should take this out? Or do you write a bit and then redraft it and then...
I write in a very weird way. The first like 86 pages of my novels, like I can recite them for you. Like I usually know every single word for the first 86 pages because they're kind of scored musically a bit. I mean, the new novel...
Are they written in one flow, or do you sort of pore over each word, refining it and refining it?
Yeah, no, I refine and refine and refine. And I do this weird technique. I don't know if it's a technique or, like I say, a sign of brain damage. I do this kind of cutting and pasting a lot. So I collage a lot. And then, but I'm obsessed with the way that the syntax is. The syntax is up to stuff in my books. Again, I don't know if anybody's noticed this, but there are parts in Bina where, you know, there's things that I'm doing with language sort of accidentally, deliberately. So I go in and I try to find that and make that. I'm very auditory. So I often think of it like music. So I can't keep going unless it's out of tune. And so now we'll see, right? Because those are three works that I've completed that I wrote in that manner. I mean, I remember being, I mean, this is the hilarious thing about being a writer, the glamorous life of a despairing writer. I remember like there were several Christmases where I just wasn't able to participate in Christmas. Because I was either copy editing a book or I was writing a book. And I remember one Christmas, it was Malarkey. And I'd gone over to visit a friend of mine, Helen, and they were playing this game Croconole with my son. And I was not able to play. I was in her other room, and I was literally reading Malarkey aloud and beating out the sentences in it to hear, was it in tune? And then the following, and there was another Christmas, that must have been 2011, or maybe it was 2010. I get confused with the years. But then there was another one where my son's grandma had taken us like skiing for a few days. Well, I don't ski because I can't ski. So I just stayed indoors and I was doing exactly the same type of work on Martin John. And then I think I realized like, God, this is like three Christmases I just don't participate. Like, and Christmas Day has always not been the time when I kind of get a lot of work done.
It must have been strange from the other room to hear Martin John and Malarkey.
Being re-read. I mean, when I
gives a different atmosphere too.
Yeah, Christmas like dinner, when I think back on it, it was pretty insane. But that was like I had a small child, I had no money, and I had like a job. I used to write kind of gambling news. And we were like dirt poor. And, you know, I just had to, in a way, now I'm in a different situation because I do have time to write now. I mean, we're still certainly struggling financially, but at least I have time in a way that I never, ever had time historically. And as a result, I'm a lot less productive. I write nothing compared to what I did when I had no time, you know, and a kid and a job and deep poverty. So that just goes to show, right? Whatever people are out there feeling like they have barriers, sometimes.
And is the reading and the writing, that goes hand in hand, I guess. Is that something that happens once you've kind of got to a certain state on the page that you start reading it, or would you sort of write a paragraph and read it aloud straight away,
you know,
before
really,
you go on to the next paragraph?
You know, it's really interesting because it's actually quite difficult to answer these questions because, you know, when you're doing it, you're not actually kind of conscious of it. I don't know. I wish I'd sort of paid attention to this now for the last few weeks before I did this interview. Well, every book is different, right? Like, I'm writing a new book at the moment that is a very different book. It was supposed to be a quartet of novels. And this book, I had been writing it simultaneously with Bina. And it was, my plan was I wanted to publish two novels at the same time because I wanted to make a diptych. Because I felt like Malarkey and Martin John were a diptych, but they were, you could read them separately and they were published at different times. So I conceptually wanted to set the bar a bit different or higher. So I was like, yeah, I want to make like two panels in a painting. I want to have two novels and I want to put them in the world simultaneously. And I sold them to my publisher in that way. And then, so I was writing them simultaneously and there were elements where they kind of spoke to one another. But then when I finished the draft of Bina, I realized why was I subordinating like this book that was so sort of resolutely about one woman, and not just one woman, like an entire and her life and her departure from the planet. And, you know, I mean, she started to feel by the end of it a bit Beowulfian or something, you know, and we don't. So I wanted to make, you know, then I realized, well, why am I doing that? And I was like, oh, I'm doing that because I don't think that a novel about a woman is enough. Like, I feel like she's not enough. There needs to be more, because I've been conditioned my whole life to believe that, you know, a novel about a woman isn't enough. like, do you know what I mean?
In the other novel, is it not, is it about a man? The focus of it, I guess, is what I'm going to get to. But you felt that was because of that conditioning, by giving that more attention at the time, you were falling into the trap that you've just
described. No, I felt that readers and reviewers, if indeed there will be any reviewers left in the world by the time this book gets finished, I felt that what they'd do is they'd read both the books potentially, but they'd only be looking at what the connection between the books were. Mm-hmm. And that therefore, like, there's something in Bina that, like, there's some, like, philosophical profundity that I got at in that book about female friendship. Sorry, that sounds very, very kind of silly and sanctimonious and, I don't know, loaded. But I know it. Like, I know it. I know it because that's actually one of the few things that I have lived. I've lived what it is, that profundity to have those kinds of friendships. And I wanted to somehow lace that through a novel. And I feel like that novel did that. And even though, like, whatever, maybe nobody's noticing, maybe they are, who cares? You know, that is one thing I do hold on to. Like, there's very, very little that I know about the books that I've written. So I'm not a person who goes, wow, I wrote a great book. I always worry about my books. I always think something's wrong with them, or they're not doing what they need to do. Even after they're published, I worry about them. You know, even retroactively, I worry about them. But there's one thing I do know about Bina, and that I hit something there that I wanted to hit. Like, I'm glad to have lived a life and been alive. And even if that's the only useful thing I ever did, I'm really glad I did that for the four people that will read it and recognize it. I'm really happy about that. I'm proud of that. It wasn't like a gendered reckoning. It was more that I knew that I'd said something profound about the complexity of, because essentially in Bina, you know, she is a supporter of autonomy and end of life choice, but then she's struck with this question when her closest friend asks her to help her. And it's that notion of, well, not you, yeah, everybody else, but not you, right? And I've always wrestled with that, because I've had a few friends who've committed suicide, and I'm a real supporter of autonomy and dying. I mean, I just went to the hospital this morning and volunteered to help someone who, because, you know, I volunteer as a witness to help people make their application forms, because we have medical assistance in dying here in Canada, but people can't apply unless they have two independent witnesses. And sometimes it can be hard for people to get people who will support them, because, you know, some people have conscientious objections. But so we have a like volunteer program here in Canada, And so I'm a volunteer. And so I'm somebody who absolutely believes in the right autonomy to end your life. If you're, especially if you're, I mean, obviously if you're suffering intolerably, but when I've really, really struggled when people have made essentially autonomous decisions to end their lives, without necessarily having any, you know, terminal illness or anything. And I can't resolve that. And there again, that's the big contradiction of being a human being. I can be so clear about autonomy, but then, you know, my good friend takes their life and I'm destroyed. So because we're fundamentally very contradictory. Humans are absolutely big contradictions.
Well, thank you for listening, and thank you to Anna-Kaina Schofield for joining us.
You can find about Anna-Kaina and her writing in the description below the podcast, and you can find us at unsoundmethods.co.uk, on Twitter at unsoundmethods, and you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com or on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
You can find more about me at jamiebatchin.com or on Twitter at jamiebatchin or on Instagram at jamie_batchin. Thank you for listening. Take care. Talk to you next month.